Michigan Liberation is a statewide network of people and organizations organizing to end the criminalization of Black families and communities of color in Michigan. We envision a state without mass incarceration, mass policing, and punishment. We envision a state with the best public education in the nation, single-payer health care, and thriving Black and brown communities. Here on the Respect the Roots podcast, we will lift up the stories and experiences of those impacted by mass incarceration, collective ties to the criminal legal system, and the frontline efforts to end mass incarceration.
What's up, everybody? It's Ms. Marjan, and welcome to another episode of Respect the Roots, Michigan Liberation's podcast. I'm telling you, we have another great episode planned for you today. In the studio with me, I've got Leon Benson, the CEO of 448 or 448 Productions. Did I get that right, Leon?
You got that right.
What's going on, Leon?
Well, how you doing? I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much, Marjan.
Oh, hey, no, I'm about to cut you up because I want to make sure everybody hear you and everything. I'm going to have you come just a little bit
more,
brother.
You need me
to
come a little closer?
Just a little closer.
A little closer.
Because, you know, we about to have a serious convo.
Okay, you already know. It ain't nothing wrong with that. I'll hug you if I get any closer.
Yes. But, Leon, you know, I mean, we have interviewed so many people here on this podcast. You know, we did one with Marvin Cotton Jr. Shout out to Marvin,
oh, yeah,
who came
Marvin,
in, yeah,
man.
Who's doing his thing, and you
Great
know, Marvin, to tell you, he did in you know prison 19 years, 7 months, and 12 days, and everything. And I know you here to tell your story,
yeah,
and everything. And you did what?
24 years, 7 months, and 9 days.
Wow,
say in the state of Indiana too. At that.
Say that again, and I want you to get even closer, because I got to pump up your mic a little bit more.
24 man. Years, yeah. 7 months, and 9 days
wow.
in the prison in Indiana. And 10 of those years were spent consecutively in solitary confinement.
Wow, y'all. I told you, we about to bring it. So, Leon, I want you to talk about your story, your history. How did all this come to be and everything? Tell us about Leon.
Well, you know, one thing I want to say, you know, much love and shouts out to Michigan Liberation, because I was raised in Flint, Michigan, you know, for a majority of my life, you know, before I went to prison on the north side. And, you know, had a typical, you know, background, you know, as a kid, working class family. You know, unfortunately, you know, fell to the woes of the crack epidemic, you know, my parents and stuff like that. Those were some difficult times. But I think despite all of those difficult times of, you know, me growing up, I feel like I still had like a childhood. You know, I really was big into art, drawing, painting, sculpting. And that love turned into the love of hip hop and create music and mixtapes. And, you know, that kind of came with me, you know, everywhere I went. You know, unfortunately, you know, I took some of the bad habits that the crack epidemic, you know, put upon, you know, those that grew up in it. And I started chasing fast money. I moved to Detroit early, you know. Hey, shouts out to Puritan, Fairfield, you know what I mean?
West Side,
you know, we was down there. I got a lot of love down there, you know, from the people. And I really made my bones in Detroit, you know, because I came here early, like at 19. And, you know, it was a big grooming process for me. You know, it's mad love. And it's still mad love to this day, you know. Unfortunately, I got a little lonely just being in Detroit by myself without the rest of my family. So I went back to Flint. And just ironically, the same day I went back, I had an uncle that was moving to Indianapolis, Indiana to, you know, get with his wife. And he asked me to help him move. So I helped him move. I didn't have no intentions of going down and staying in Indianapolis, Indiana. I just was helping my uncle move. And while I was down there, I had another uncle, my late uncle, now he passed, Cleveland Jr., Gibbs Jr.
Right.
But he hooked me up with a job. You know, it was a professional painting job.
In Indiana.
In Indianapolis. I was like, oh, bet, you know. Right. At that time, like in 95, making like 16 an hour. You know what I mean? I was like, hey, that was like good money for a kid too.
You was balling in a way.
Hey, I was balling. I went there and did the little job. I stayed there for a week and I made like 1600. And I was like, in comparison to what was going on in Detroit at the time with the unemployment, you know, the high cost of living, I was like, man, you know, maybe I got a shot. Man, I'm going to try it out here. You know, I don't got to sell drugs, you know. You know, right. And I went there to do that. And eventually, you know, I got laid off. I ended up, you know, creating a family, having two kids down there. But I got back into the street life.
Mm.
And, you know, like I said, in August 8th of 1998, a gentleman by the name of Casey Shane, he was 25 years old, you know, a white guy. I never met him in anything, but unfortunately, he got gunned down, right? He was shot to death while he was in his truck.
Mm.
Police never found the motive of why he was shot. He didn't have no drugs in his system, nothing like that. He was shot on the corner. This was the area that, you know, I sold in. And, you know, I definitely was the biggest dealer over there. Wow. So my name was ringing. It was a transit community in the near downtown Indianapolis space. So it was kind of like Detroit. It had a cast corridor type feel, you know, a lot of buildings and stuff. So it was very transit. And, you know, it happened. I didn't know it happened that night. I heard the shots. I was in another building.
Right.
Doing things that I was doing, you know, hearing shots like that. You know, in those communities, you know, at the time, wasn't a big deal as much. You know, we looked around and looked out the building, but we went back to what we was doing. Like, oh,
right.
Yeah, somebody's
moving.
Yeah, let's keep it moving, you know.
Right.
And, I we was desensitized. It's true. So, you know, I left. Just went back to my apartment like a couple miles away. I came out the next day. Still chasing money, you know. I probably made the most money ever made in my whole life on that day, like for real. Like, it's really surreal because that day, that night, without me knowing that that happened, I made so much money that I was like, this is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna try to be a kingpin. As ludicrous as that sounds, that was my moment. But that situation happened. And I came back not knowing what was really in store for me. And I found out that it was a white kid that got shot. I was like, wow, like who would do something so stupid? Like on the corner, we make money. You can go in a building and do your stuff. I'm not forcing people to do it.
Right.
But, you know, and I was like, So I just, you know, I kept it moving. I couldn't really do nothing in the area for a few days because the police was everywhere. And, you know, Indiana is a little bit dated than Detroit and a lot of progressive other, you know, racial progressive, you know, cities, you know, they was kind of behind. So it really was a big, big deal.
Right.
That this white gentleman was shot down like that. So they had the area on lock for several days. And, you know, long story short, I came back in the area, a fake confidential informant with the Indianapolis Police Department pointed me out to the police as being the guy that committed the crime. And I went to the police station and I started the journey of me going to prison for 60 years for a murder that I didn't commit. I went through two trials. The first was a hung jury. It was a combination of just a lot of things, a combination of my ignorance by being innocent, you know.
Right.
A combination of, you know, I had the money, but I put the money in the wrong place, wrong lawyer. The police were corrupt. The prosecutor was corrupt. And people had that moral panic down there. And just to be, you know, just frank, I mean, it was very riddled with racism. You know, I felt it. If I can empathize with our ancestors, where, you know, I'm like, man, I finna go get hung. Because when I took that walk, you know, I heard the N-word, you know, thrown at me. You know, the energy in there was like, it like, kill you, you know. We can get you right now, you know. And that's how I walked off out of there. And it was for a crime I didn't commit. I absolutely didn't commit it. So,
and let's backtrack, Leon. I want to be clear, and I want everybody to be clear, you know, when I ask you this, because a lot of people will say, wait a minute. Okay, you just got, you know, accused of doing something you didn't do, and you spent 20-something, 24 years, 7 months, 9 days for something you didn't do. How does that happen? So let's back up. You said that somebody supposedly identified you, and yeah. I want to be clear about that. You said what?
Somebody identified me. It was a cross race misidentification as well.
Mistaken identity.
Right. And one thing I want to point out to your viewers, you know, with cases of exonerations, cross race cases are rare. So white on black, Latino on white, or, you know, white on Latino, those are rare. It's really, you know, race on race crimes. So when you get a cross racial crime, it's a high probability of a wrongful conviction that can happen. And also with a cross race misidentification, this alleged eyewitness, she was a white woman. She was 50 yards away at night, you know, and she seen the shooting. From her testimony, this woman said she was loading. She was a newspaper delivery woman for the Indianapolis Star at the time. And she said she was loading her papers in those old paper boxes on the street, vending boxes. And she said she heard shots. And when she looked up, you know, to her left, she said she seen the suspect wearing all black with white stripes, like Adidas pants, you know, walking, just passing the gate, the tailgate of the truck, and then turning back around, putting more shots in the cab of the truck, and then, you know, running off. This is 50 yards away at the gate of the truck to where she was at. That's 50 yards away at night, and he ran off. So the police took her identification on the scene. And she said that the person was like 5'7", 5'6", or something, and gave the clothing description and said he was a dark-skinned, you know, black dude. You know, and I want to say this, though, you know, because right. I don't want nobody to get the wrong idea, right?
Right.
Right? You know, hey, I know I'm African, you know what I mean? I got deep roots, you know what I mean? You know, they all in me, you know, deep roots, right? Respect the roots.
Right.
But I just don't got a lot of melanin in me, like, you know, my other brothers and sisters, you know, so right. I kind of could pass, like, for a Puerto Rican brother at the time, you know, when I had my hair, you know what I mean? So it was very odd. So when I went to the police station that day, she picked me out of a photo lineup, a photo array. And pick me, right?
Wow.
You know, I was like, I'm thinking they playing with me, right? So for a little while, I wasn't taking it as serious. I'm like, this can't be. Like, I absolutely wasn't there. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, but when that first trial came, I'm like, yeah, they serious. Well, not even that. When by the time I put $15,000 on a lawyer, I'm like, man, they really gonna take me to trial for this, you know? But going into the trial, and just seeing what was at stake, and it was a hung jury, I was like, oh. But the thing about my case, it was an eyewitness that seen somebody else the whole time.
Wow. And so walk us through, especially somebody, because I know somebody's going to be, you know, listening, watching, and they're going to say, y'all, I know it. You're sitting in that courtroom, and it's guilty, right? And yeah. and it's like, talk. And then, I mean, what happened after that? Or did you immediately go straight to jail or then prison? I mean, how did that work out?
Hey, let me tell you something. Let me be honest. You know, I was one of them guys. I had a lot of bravado when I was young. You know what I mean? I was the type of guy like, man, I don't even need God, nobody, man. Hey, I'm the strongest, man. I don't care. You know, I was like one of those cocky, arrogant, you know, younger guys at the time. And I want to say this just in a humbling way for myself, right? And I try to find humor in it. And it's hard humor. But you got to laugh to keep from crying, sister. You hear me? But I'm going to tell you this. Hey, I talked all that stuff where they said guilty. Hey, I said, Jesus, help me. I said, oh, Jesus. I was like, Jesus, you know, for real.
Did
right?
you fall on the ground?
Hey, I almost did, right? I was like, oh, man, no. They was like, calm down, sir. I'm like, no, y'all are tripping. No, no, this cannot be it. Come on, stop. Right? But it was real, you know.
You immensely. I can't even. And I'm glad you got some humor because you know what? Somebody needs to hear and see that.
Yeah, yeah. You got to. You got to because if you don't bring that humor, you won't really be able to fight. And for me, you know, going through this thing is like a, you become a spiritual warrior. You got to become a spiritual warrior. And you can't do it with anger, but you can have righteous indignation, which is different from just flat out anger. It's not directed. It's reactionary. It's depressive. So you have to laugh, you know, as you go along, you know. And I try to do that.
Wow, we got our brother in the studio, Leon Benson. You're just tuning in. Hey, you don't miss the first half. We're about to go into the second half and everything. But he's from 448 Productions. But this brother did Marvin had to correct me. I said, you did the time. No, he said, I did somebody else's time.
Yeah.
You did 24 years, 7 months, and 9 days in an Indiana prison. And you hear, he's here. He don't look like nothing like what he's been through.
Thank you.
You know what I'm saying? Telling his story. So, Leon, you're in prison in Indiana. And walk us through the 24 years. Like, what did you get involved in to help you kind of get to where you at now?
Well, I'm going to say, you know, what's odd, though, you know, while I sat in the county jail, I obtained my GED.
Okay.
I'm like, man, I'm not going up. Let me get my GED. So I grabbed my GED while I was there awaiting trial.
We'll be here a little bit. Did you know you was doing 24 years?
No, I didn't think I was finna go to prison. So I got my GED while I was waiting, right? So it's like, when I got to prison, that really helped me out a lot. When I got sentenced to 60 years in prison, you know, for the crime I didn't commit. So, you know, I had to take that ride. You know, it's real. You know, ironically, everybody, when I was driving to the prison reception center in Plainfield, Indiana, the song by Casey and JoJo, I cannot make this up. How did I get life, life, life? I was like, oh, my God. Like, this was, I'm actually on a van driving to prison. Like, how did I get life? Like, 60 years is life. I can't live 60 more years. I'll be 85, 83 when I get out. But that was the mindset of me going in. When I enter prison, it looked like a big mouth, like just sucking up my soul. And, you know, all the things that you can think of. You know, people want to be macho. I told you, I thought I was macho, my bravado. You know, I didn't tell nobody. And I kept a stone face, but I was definitely afraid, you know, going into prison, like, you know, with these guys trying to take advantage of me. You know, I was from out of town, from a different state.
Yes.
You know, so I ain't really had no roots there. So I definitely had my guards up going in. And when I came through, and I had my share of battles, you know. For some people, you know, you might have seen me. I'm not saying I won all my fights. You know what I mean? Sometimes you got to get a good ass whooping to really fight, you know. And I took a couple of them. But I'm going to tell you this, you know, when you seen me got out of that, I had one shoe on. And people was like, man, why you got one shoe on getting up out of there? Because I left it in somebody behind, you know, trying to play games with me. And that's what you had to do because I was
man,
a young guy.
Leah, wait a minute. You said you was walking around with one shoe on because the other shoe was in somebody's backside.
And in their backside, right? Because you can't play that because I was a handsome young dude. I was handsome, and, you know, I was like, you had to protect yourself, right?
I can imagine.
So, yeah, and people, I got into a lot of disputes early on over my innocence because I didn't understand the etiquette of prison. You know, if you go into prison, everybody say they innocent. And
right.
It make it seem like you nagging to somebody that's been there 20 or 10 or 15 years. I'm like, man, you know, I'm innocent. They like, man, like, because if you minding them of all the time they did. But, you know, outside of some of those things and my delusional reprieve that I had because I kept my boots on about the first year when I went to sleep. Because I told him, I was like, why you got your boots on? I said, I'm going to be ready to go when they come get me. I'm like, they're going to come get me. This can't be real. So I was kind of like in that stage of grief. You know, I was in that denial, like I'm here. But what I was able to do was get into college early on. So that's what I did. And, you know, it was first time in college. I got all A's. I was like really proud of myself. And all of a sudden, a prison riot happened.
Wow.
So the prison riot happened. It was like six guards that got stomped out. And this was a coalition, right? This is something that never happened in the history of that prison of Wabash Valley Correctional Facility, that white prisoners, Latino prisoners, blacks, different gangs, everybody just got together and they just went at the guards that day. And it was like six guards that was like critically injured. I didn't have nothing to do with it. I would love to admit that I had something to do with it. So I just went on about, you know, my bit. You know, we went on lockdown for a couple months. We got off. I'm back in college next semester. And they come get me and accuse me of being in a riot. It was a confidential informant said, yeah, they call me LB, my initials, right. You know, in joint. They say, LB, man, I seen LB stumping out the guard. I'm like, what? Man. Come on. And that's where I was placed in solitary confinement from November 2001 to February 2011.
Wow. Wait, how long were you in solitary confinement?
That's like,
I gotta write this. Wait.
That's like 9 years. Like 9 years and 3 months.
Wow. Right?
So I was there and they had me there. They weren't gonna let me go. They put me on administrative segregation, meaning that your time was indefinite. They had to pick when you would go out. But in time I figured out it was a conspiracy theory. It wasn't a theory. It was a conspiracy because of my case, right? So they held me there and got in my way of me fighting my case because I had to go pro se. I was on lockup. It was hard. I had to learn it and do what I do, but they was in my way every fight, every step, every second of the way. And the reason why I say that, because a lawyer, a rogue lawyer, jumped on my case without my permission. So I had to withdraw my post-conviction relief. Obviously, my direct appeal was denied. But when I got to that stage, I had to withdraw. And according to federal law, you have to file your appeals within a year to save your time to go into the federal courts. And hey, I left my case out of court for like a year while I pursued a civil suit to get the money back that he stole from me and jumped on my case. And after that was done, and I got nothing from that. I got stonewalled on that. I'm talking about like some unbelievable stuff. Like, it's like I can't make it up. I got all my paperwork too, but they let me out.
Out of prison.
No, out of solitary.
Out of solitary. I was about to say, okay, wait.
Right.
They let you out of solitary. And bear with me. We've got about 4 minutes, but Leon, you're going to have to stay and do a part two. You got to stay here in the studio.
Okay.
And we're going to keep it moving. But I'm going to let you finish your 4 minutes, but this is so intriguing. And I knew you had a powerful story because one of our brothers, Booker T, shout out to Booker T and everything. I'm about to say, well, Booker T Washington. We always tease him, you know, because it just rolled with it. But, you know, he brought you to one of our meetings, our Michigan Liberation meetings, and he was talking about not only are you talented, but your story and everything. Yeah. And I think we need to really, really go deeper into this. And then, of course, talk about all the amazing things you're doing. I know you're very talented. You can rap. You got your production company. And that's what we'd love to hear. But just for the 3 minutes and so, and we'll come back in for the part two. This will be the part one, but we'll come back for part two. Leon, so let me just make sure I got this right. So when we get ready for part two, you're in prison in Indiana. You were, you know, just doing the time, not right. Your time, the time.
The time.
And you still in denial about how much, because you really don't know you got so many years to do. You like, any minute I'll probably get out.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go ahead and go to school while I'm in here, wait, you know, whatever. whoop-de-whoop. And then it's like you said, here comes this big riot situation.
Yeah.
And you like, oh man, show is a shame, right? And then it's like, now help me out, you know. And then you're like, okay, well, I wasn't involved in it. But then again, next thing you know, you are blamed for it and you put in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And with 2 minutes left, I mean, I want to start the next section or, you know, part two. What is, because you know what? Let's be real. Like I told Marvin in his conversation with me and everything, a lot of us are totally clueless of what's really going on behind closed doors.
Yeah.
I'm serious, my brother. Like, when you say solitary confinement, we going off of what we see on TV. And I would love for you to give us the difference between just being in prison versus going into solitary confinement. And then also, were you in state or federal prison? That's something, you know.
I was in the state prison.
Okay. And see, what's the difference between federal versus state? I don't know if you know, kind of. So we can kind of get an idea and everything, because I think it's important that we not only tell your story, but we educate people.
Hey, I really appreciate that. I would say, solitary confinement is a very oppressive place, you know, especially when you think about the mental aspect of it. I'm falsely incarcerated 2 times. So the difference between regular population and solitary confinement, I know a lot of your listeners probably heard of the term the belly of the beast. The belly of the beast has been a metaphor that talks about prison. You in the belly of the beast. So that's what the population is. But the solitary confinement is like the womb of the beast, because you put into this gestation chamber. And we know that an elephant got the longest gestational period of all mammals of like 23 months. But when you are put in solitary indefinitely, you never know when you will be rebirthed up out of there. The opening of the doors, the umbilical cord, the amniotic fluids would be the psychological pressures that you are feeling, you know, with the walls, you know, closing in. And I seen a lot of people lose their mind and their wellness in there. And that was a place that I was being destroyed by the state.
Well, y'all, hang on for part two. We're going to go out and then we're going to come back in, Leon. All right, here on Respect the Roots. Michigan Liberation Education Fund, C3, conducts grassroots organizing, leadership development, and civic engagement activities. Michigan Liberation, C4, and Michigan Liberation Action Fund, IE, are sister organizations.